Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hello, you two.
Folks, this is Dumdy Dum, the show about the reality darky drama that is centred at Ambridge in the heart of the Midlands. And of course, I am Royfield. 2018 has seen some Dumdy Dum Patreon content. Now, to access this content, what you've got to do is to become a member of Patreon. Quite simply, you spend $2 per show, and then you get email links from me when I interview various Archers actors. And when we do special content. Now, this year we spoke to a few Archers actors behind the scenes, and I think that some of those conversations have been really illuminating, and it's great to speak to my heroes. What I thought I'd do as a special one-off is to give you some extracts of three of those interviews with Anya, with Tim, and with Annabelle, as way of a little present to say thank you for all of your support in 2018. That support doesn't have to be monetary, though Lucy and I quite like the monetary support. So if you'd like access to behind the scenes Archers interview content in 2019, go on to patreon.com. But that support can be being a caller in a row. It can be writing a review on iTunes or another podcatching service, or just telling your friends and family about Dumdy Dum. So as I said, without further ado, here is some extracts of some of the interviews that I've conducted this year. Have a happy new year. Bye-bye.
Now, I take away different things from the interviews I do. With Tim, who plays David Archer, he kind of exudes a blokish charm, and you really get the sense that Tim is very much in the old tradition of the kind of the rep actors that used to be a mainstay of the Archers when he joined in the early 1980s. With Anya, we had so many things in common, like we kind of lived in the same bit of London, that I just descended into flirting outrageously. Becky, who played Nick Grundy, with her I felt a real warmth, a kind of a kindred spirit. But in this interview, I was completely taken aback by Annabelle's honesty and very obvious love for the character of Kirsty. And it really made me realise that she's probably still only a character in the show because of the brilliance of Annabelle's acting. Anyway, why don't you decide?
This is Dumdy Dum, the show about the reality docudrama that is centred on Ambridge in the heart of the Midlands. I'm Royfield Brown. I'm just a fan. And I get no greater joy than when I get to speak to the actors, the people behind the voices on our wonderful docudrama. Who are you? Who have I got with me this week?
You have Annabelle Dowler.
A.K.A.?
Kirsty Miller.
Woohoo! Now, Annabelle, I got a very serious question to ask you first off.
Right.
Now, I know you've got a long-studded, starred career. But the best night of your professional life was obviously the Dum Dum Awards.
Oh, my God,
now,
it was.
Now, be honest. Was it actually winning the award, or was it the fact that you got to meet the person who did the Happy House mix of your plaintive wail?
That...
What was the highlight of your professional career?
Oh, my God. Was that the whole thing was surreal, can I just say? From my agent ringing me and saying, oh, now, Annabelle, yes, you've won an award. And I was like, oh, BAFTA, oh, Sony, not heard of that one. Anyway, and then to being given a mug on that stage, a mug which I have to say, don't have many mugs, haven't got a lot of space in the kitchen, so I tend to use that mug on a daily basis. But then that mix that you did, which I have since tried to find on YouTube, I can't find it, you'll have to send me the link so I can just show friends. Oh, my word, that haunted me for weeks. I don't think I've ever heard anything quite so terrifying as the way you sort of, you'd cut my scream, my wail, and my I Love You Toms into this weird musical mix. That, and then somebody else, who I'm sure is one of your tweet-along friends, came up to me with her phone and had her ringtone as of me wailing in the vestry. That was her ringtone.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a bit of a bizarre night.
Well, bizarre in a nice way. And you know what? And I still got the picture of me giving you a little bit of a hug.
Yeah. Aww.
Didn't realise how small you were. You're diminutive, yeah. Aren't you?
You never
get the sense that Kirsty on The Archers is diminutive because you're such a light, a loud and bright character.
I know, I'm 5'1". So you have to make up for it some way.
So let's wind all the way back because you're from Formby. So tell us about those formative years.
Well, I'm from Formby, which is north of Liverpool. And actually, my parents are still in the same house there. I'm going back home for Easter. Pretty normal, happy upbringing. Well, normal as far as I thought everything was normal, you know, but two sisters, stayed in the same house, primary school, secondary school in the same area. Always started doing drama when I was about 10 in a little drama club in Formby. And started doing all the sort of festivals. We used to do like verse speaking and improvisation and these sort of terrifying classes. We'd go to Crosby and Southport and do them. And then I got into youth theatre in Southport, and then I did Manchester Youth Theatre, which was fantastic, actually, because I did it when I was 16, 17. And you got to spend the whole summer living away. So it was like a sort of dress rehearsal for uni, really. You'd live away for 5 weeks in the summer in halls of residence in Manchester, and you just with all these kids, these teenagers with the same interests as you, and you all put on a show at the end of the summer in a theatre in Manchester, and then went back to school thinking you were so superior and more grown up to all your schoolmates now. And I did that a couple of years and absolutely loved it. And then I went to Bristol Uni and did Spanish and drama. And then I went to live in Spain for 2 years. So I didn't go to drama school straight away. I sort of knew I wanted to be an actress, but I had this sort of mad passion for Spain and Spanish, and I sort of wanted to get that out of my system first. So I thought, well, I can't really do it the other way around. I can't stop being an actress and then decide to go and live in Spain. So better to go and do the whole Spanish thing first. And that's what I did.
Ay, pero qué maravilla. Oh, thanks to EasyJet, I can now go to see my familia in Spain for only £50. I can see Pablo in Madrid, Jose in Malaga, y mamá y papá in Palma, Mallorca for only £50 return with EasyJet. It's incredible. Que voy a ir a la playa. Que voy a ponerme... Offer ends midnight, Monday, June the 14th. Terms and conditions apply.
So is it fairly safe to say that you had a somewhat happy but kind of solid middle-class upbringing?
Yeah, it is safe to say that. I mean, I went to a secondary school which was very mixed, you know, and my mum and dad actually didn't have a Scouse accent because my mum had gone to the convent school in Southport, but I just didn't have a strong accent. And I felt very aware at my secondary school that my mum and dad were quite posh compared to the other kids, or at least to some of them. There was a real mixture of class at my school. And I remember even complaining to my parents before they went to parents' evening, sort of saying, oh, God, please, can you say bath and not bath? And can you say up, not up, to fit in with the other parents? And then I went to Bristol Uni, where everyone was, oh, my God, they're so like that. So what did you do on your year abroad? And I was like, well, no one in my school took a gap year unless they were resitting their A-levels. And I was like, oh, I went to Corfu on holiday and did Manchester Youth Theatre. And they were all, I love your accent. And I just, I was not Scouse compared to real Scousers in my school. So I always felt a bit in between classes, do you know what I mean? I felt, but, you know, and that's probably why at Bristol, when I met all the drama crew, that's where I most fitted in, actually, when I was doing lots of plays in the Drama Society. Because I loved Spanish, but most of the Spanish department in Bristol were very upper middle class. Mm-hmm. People who'd already had their gap year in Argentina because their dad was in the embassy there or something. But I mean, I love Spanish, but I loved my time at uni doing lots of plays in the student union mostly.
Let's go back to this accent thing before we do the Spanish thing, because I know that Spain and Spanish culture plays a big part in your life. For the uninitiated, you sound like you are straight out of Brookside. Mm-hmm. Right, I'm a Brummie, so I can't hear the difference. And I actually think that one of the appeals of the character of Kirsty actually is her accent. And I think it's not by accident that you're probably, with the exception of Johnny, you're probably the last kind of major actor that's come into it with a regional accent. Describe the difference between a Formby accent for us and maybe someone from Runcorn or someone who's actually from Toxteth.
Basically, obviously, you've got your early Scouse accent when people talking like that, and I never had that, and my family never had that, but I've had to do it a lot for jobs. Mm-hmm. When I was at drama school, I remember the head of our drama school saying to me, they went around analysing your casting and all this, and he sort of said, the problem with you is that you look like you should be in a period drama, but you sound like you should be in Brookside. And one, I thought, I really don't sound like I should be in Brookside. If I was, I did audition for Brookside once, funny enough, and I had to make myself sound a lot Scouser, you know. So my accent's never been that really harsh Scouse. In fact, a lot of people, when they don't know me, sometimes think I'm Welsh because I think I sound like I might be from North Wales. And within the centre of Liverpool, there'll be different elements of the Scouse accent and different levels of it. But actually, Formby, and my accent is not a typical Formby accent now, is more like that. A lot of people in Formby have moved from Liverpool and they've maybe made a bit more money and they've moved to what they think is the posh part. So you've got that sort of new money Formby accent. I hope no one's listening to this from Formby because they'll hate me. But anyway, my accent now, I would just say, is that I've definitely got the Merseyside lilt and I've got my Bath, my harsh sort of A sound of the Bath last, that sort of thing. I've never really been a mum upstairs. I've never had that. So I would just say it's a sort of, for me, it's a soft Merseyside accent, but it gets stronger when I'm with people from back home and, you know, and it depends. And as I say, I was so used to, before the Archers, actually, I'd never used my natural accent in any job. I'd always either had to make it properly Scouse, properly recognisable as a Liverpudlian, or get rid of it because it was had to be RP or it was something period or whatever. And when I went for my Archers audition, because I had no idea what they wanted, they just said, well, we don't want you to be you're not one of the country folk. We don't want that country accent and you're not posh. But we don't want you to sound, you know, specifically from, you know, not a strong regional accent. So that's why I think if I went back now and heard my first few episodes, it would probably vary from being a bit, even a bit, because if you just go 15 minutes up the train line to Southport, where I'm from in Formby, it starts going a bit more like that, slightly more Lancashire or more Manchester, do you know what I mean? That's sort of what we used to call a woolly bat when I was at school. But then you go 15 minutes the other way up north towards, south towards Liverpool, and it gets more like that. So it literally changes on the train line within a few stops. It's incredible. And that's what I always find fascinating about England, the amount of accents, even within such a small region. So, yeah, so I think my accent probably did vary a bit in those first few episodes. I don't know. But in the end, I've ended up just using my own accent. But I'm always aware that Kirsty's a bit younger than me, and I think that's always in my head a bit. So I sort of think I sound a bit younger on The Archers than I do in real life, but that might be just me. I don't know.
Well, I must admit, when I was looking at your kind of actor notes, the character notes earlier today, I was surprised. It is like a almost 10 years younger than you're supposed to be. But that's one of the great things about being a voice actor is that, you know, your voice doesn't have to betray your age, but you sound young anyway.
Do I? Well, is it because I've got quite a low register? I'm in a choir and I'm actually in the tenors.
Well, you don't sound like a languid divorcee, do you? You don't sound like, you know, you smoke a whole load of fags and you've lived life the hard way. No. You don't.
No. So I don't know. Maybe it's just about, like you say, it's about having energy in your voice makes you sound younger sometimes. I don't know. It might be that. Speed at which I speak. I know I do tend to speak too fast. So my parents have always told me anyway.
Well, not too fast for me.
She said she had to make him stop. And how did you interpret those words?
Well, isn't it obvious? He'd attacked her.
Your Honour, I object to this line of questioning. The defence are inviting the witness to speculate.
I agree, Mr. Bywater.
But what else could it mean?
Thank you, Miss Miller.
Look at him, sitting there, shaking his head. Well, I'm telling you, Rob Titchener is the worst kind of abuser because he doesn't leave any bruises. He lies and he bullies and he manipulates. He tried to destroy my best friend and he's still doing it.
Any more outbursts, you'll be held in contempt. Is that understood?
Fine by me. I've said what I came here to say.
You finished school, you've gone to uni, but you mentioned the radio drama. Was it Radio Rep? I'm got a little bit confused here. Well, you mentioned something which you said you'd done in your year before
Manchester, which was like a residential sort of drama summer camp, I suppose. You lived away and you did a play at the end of the summer. So I did that for two summers before I went to uni. And then when I finished uni, I'd been doing plays all the way through uni. So I knew I wanted to be an actress, but I just...
Why? Why? What was it about?
I just love doing play after play after play. And I just love getting into a script and the rehearsals. And
what was the first thing that you learnt when you were not to Manchester that's really stuck with you?
God, I don't know. I've been doing plays before that with other local drama groups and with Formby Theatre Club, which my mum did lots of amateur theatre. And that's how I got into it, I suppose, going and seeing her in plays. Funnily enough, my mum had to understudy me once for a two-week run we did. And 2 weeks for an amateur group was quite a long time, you know. And I was Pinocchio. And they said to my mum, look, will you be Annabelle's understudy? And my mum said, oh, yes, well, obviously thinking she'd never have to go on. And I got this terrible bout of flu. And my poor mother had to suddenly squeeze herself, age 50 or something, into my shorts and my faithful script. And she had no idea the script. She just kept shouting out, into the woods, to the woods, and running off into the wings to get her lines. I had been doing lots of that sort of stuff. So I really could not tell you what I learned. I just knew I loved doing it. I got incredibly nervous, but I got a massive adrenaline buzz from it, and I knew I just wanted to do more of it. But I did have this passion for Spanish as well. And, you know, and I was academic at school and I got a good degree, and I didn't want to just abandon the Spanish. So I did a TEFL course to teach English as a foreign language, and I just got a single ticket and went to live in Madrid as soon as I finished uni, thinking, well, I can come back and I can deal with drama school and the possibility of that later, which is what I did. I actually got into a theatre company while I was in Madrid, and it was called English Theatre Workshop, and it was great because we got to tour a lot of Spain, and it was two English actors and two Spanish actors, and we spoke in Spanish on stage about Shakespeare and performed extracts from his plays in English. I absolutely loved it, but soon realised that if I stayed in Spain, my career would be quite limited, because even though my Spanish was good, you know, you want to be a native. And also I didn't look typically English. You know, the Spanish often thought I was Spanish because I'm small and dark curly hair. So somebody said to me, well, why don't you go to drama school, go back to London and go to drama school? So I did. I knew nothing about it. I knew, had no idea about how to get into the business in England. I didn't know the name of a casting director or an agent. So I applied to do a postgrad back in London, and after 2 years in Madrid, I moved back and did that.
John.
Yes?
John, I've met someone. I wanted to be in a beautiful place to tell you. That's why I wanted us to come to Cleveland's.
So that's why we cycled 30 miles. Thank you very much. Thank you for nothing.
Oh, don't be like that. Because love is such a beautiful thing. Oh, I am so happy. And I'm so sad. I am sad, John. And I'm so happy. Oh, please be happy for me, John. I mean... Oh, I can tell by your face. I know, John. I know. I didn't want to hurt you. I mean, it isn't right for us, is it?
How many hearts did you leave broken in Spain?
Oh, God. Well, I didn't break a heart there, but I tried to keep something going from there. And that lasted. We did keep that going for a while, but it wasn't easy. But not with a Spaniard, with an Irishman, actually. So I was still going back to Spain a lot to visit him. But I knew I wanted to do it. I knew I just had to do it. I had to go to drama school. Once I got that, did the audition and got the place, that was it. I knew that was the next stage to go to.
So you moved to London for the first time then, I take it?
Yes, yep. I had no idea. And I had a South African cousin living in Fulham. And I moved in with her and, yeah, I didn't know London at all. And when we moved out of that flat, I moved in with my sister and we really didn't have a clue where we were going. We got Loot. It was before you could go online and look for flats. We were going through literally looking by price. We weren't even looking by area. So we do these have these ridiculous Saturdays where we'd view a cheap flat, you know, up in Wood Green in North London, then go down to Brixton and looking at a cheap flat there. We just didn't know until we just found one that we sort of liked. Although I remember my parents visiting us in this awful flat in Tulse Hill, which I actually don't live that far from there now, but at the time it was awful. It's nice now, but just being sort of horrified at this place we'd chosen to be our home. But it was sort of all we could afford at the time.
When you moved to London, you literally were given two things. You're told to buy the Loot and you're given an A to Z.
Yeah.
Because how the hell could you navigate this ridiculously large place otherwise? And I'm somewhat nostalgic for that. So what, round about what year was that? When did you actually move to London?
I went to drama school in 97. Mm-hmm. And I bought a bike. I was living in Fulham and my drama school was in South Kensington. I remember getting a bus to Battersea, buying a secondhand bike for £5 and cycling. I'd never cycled in London before and I never actually cycled into town. But I just did that journey every day. Uh-huh. Fulham through some of the lovely back streets of Earl's Court to my drama school, which was on a gorgeous mews in South Kensington. And I was just there for a year and I had the best year. There was only 10 of us on our course, 5 guys, 5 girls. And it was just such a laugh. And I just loved it because it was all mapped out for you. It was all, your whole life was timetabled again. It was lovely to be back in that sort of, have that structure. But it was just a year because I'd already done my 4 years at uni and I'd lived abroad for 3 years, actually, 1 year during uni and then 2 years in between. And I'd been in a theatre company. So I was doing it less for the formal training, but more to be sort of launched into the world of casting directors and agents and all that, which I had no clue about at all.
So this is the late 90s and you're going to start playing Kirsty in 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, right. Earlier, 99, you know. 99.
Oh, wow. Right. So fill in those 2 years for us. What were you doing professionally? What are the standout bits of your career then? And also, the other people on the course, do you still keep in contact with them? And what are they doing if they're in the business at all?
Well, one guy went straight into insurance and no one's heard of him since. Actually, everyone else, there's one guy we sort of lost contact with. All the girls, they are my best friends. One of them I'm seeing tomorrow. One of them is filming on a job that I've just filmed on. So they're really good friends. I was lucky in that the casting director from the National came to see our showcase, which is what you do at the end of drama school. Mm-hmm. And I got a job doing Peter Pan at the National. And it was a small part. I was the maid.
Is your mum your understudy?
No, she wasn't. She didn't like to be. But guess who I was made to? David Troughton, who plays Tony Archer. He was the darling and he was Hook. And I was the darling family's maid in Peter Pan. And I mean, that was brilliant to go from drama school to work there. Such a brilliant place. And I've not worked there since. So that's my goal. I want to get back to the National. So I did that. And then I did a play at Birmingham Rep. And it's there, when I was at Birmingham doing a play, that I was introduced to Sue Wilson, who was part of the radio drama team at Birmingham, at Pebble Mill. And she said to me, look, come in while you're doing this play in Birmingham, come in and just bring loads of different pieces, anything you want, any accent, just any monologues, which was such a luxury. You never get to do that. So I just went in and had a coffee with her and just sat there and just read lots of extracts of plays and little monologues in loads of different accents. And 2 weeks later, she gave me my first afternoon play, which Sonny Ormond was in, who plays Lillian. Mm-hmm. And then I did another play, and it was doing that that Julie, one of the directors, the Archers, she came to listen to the read-through, and then she came up and said, will you come and audition for the Archers? And they were actually looking for Kirsty and Brenda at the time. So that was it. I went back and auditioned for Kirsty, and that was a year after I'd left drama school.
Right, so it's 1999. So it was still at Pebble Mill then?
Yeah.
It hadn't moved. Set the scene for the newer listeners that won't even know what Pebble Mill was.
Oh, well, Pebble Mill was the Birmingham BBC TV studios. And what is fantastic is that when I was at school, when I was 14, I was in the Madrigals. We were called the Mads, and we were the Madrigal singing group. There were 16 girls. And it wasn't an all-girls school. For some reason, there were 16 of us who sang in this magical group. And we had a very talented boy in our school. It was like the sort of young Andrew Lloyd Webber. And he composed a song and he entered it for the BBC Song for Christmas competition, which was filmed at Pebble Mill every year. Every Christmas, there was this competition on TV. And we got through, and we did it. We did it 2 years, actually. We got through to the final and we all got put up in Birmingham for the night and we got to spend 2 days in the TV studio filming our song and the competition. And we didn't win the first year, but we had the most amazing time. And that is when I went, oh my gosh, I just want to work in this. I want to work behind the scenes in TV. I don't care what I do. I want to work at the BBC. I was just mad about it. I fell in love with everyone. Philip Schofield presented it. It was at a time when he was doing, do you remember the broom cupboard thing? When he was the first person to do the links between kids' TV programmes. I think I almost fainted when I saw him. I've got my photo with him. The whole thing, I just fell in love with. I loved everyone on the team, from the runners to the director. I just thought everyone was so cool. And I've got, you know, photos of me and my friends from school with our thumbs up outside the big Pebble Mill studio sign. And then cut to, however many years later, I couldn't believe that I was being paid to work there. And it was great, Pebble Mill, because it felt like you were really at the centre of so many programmes being made, and the big BBC canteen had a real buzz about it. So although the mailbox where we are now is great because its location is much nearer to the station in Birmingham and the canal and the restaurants and the shops, there's a real nostalgia I've got for Pebble Mill. You know, the mailbox is very much like a studio in the middle of an open plan office, whereas you really did feel like you're at the centre of an exciting media hub at Pebble Mill.
Your story is so close to mine in terms of the reason why I actually fell in love with media.
Mm.
Because I did needlework at school, basically.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I remember my head of house saying to me, Brown, when I showed him my options, and it was art and needlework and technical drawing. He said, Brown, this is a joke boy. And I said, no, I'm going to be a fashion designer.
Mm.
And he sent a letter home to my parents. And my mum and dad wrote a letter back to us, none of this email stuff, and said, no, he's very serious. He wants to be a fashion designer. Anyway, cutting a long story short, after me being the only boy, like, for 50 years to take CSE needlework as a subject, I was picked by the BBC as a 16-year-old to represent my school in a design competition.
Wow.
Of which the final was at Television Centre. And so the story is really timed to what you're saying. It was a Tuesday. The Aussies to film Top of the Pops on a Tuesday. We're in the studio next door. Us kids were all dressed up and people queuing to get into Top of the Pops studios. I remember these two girls said to me, so what band are you in? And I just made some random name up. I signed two autographs. And then we were taken into the BBC canteen and I saw Michael Burke. I was like, holy cow. I went, forget fashion. It's all about the media for me. So it was literally so similar to what you said there, Annabelle. That school trip took me into another world. Mm-hmm. And, you know. So basically, I could have been like some big ass fashion designer right now, the Gianni Versace of Birmingham or whatever. But here I am, a lowly podcaster, you know, in my bedroom in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, no less. Well, you know, don't put yourself down.
Well, no. Things could have turned out worse.
Well, excuse me.
Sorry, didn't see you there.
It's all right. Oh, this is the bollocks, isn't it? Coldplay were on the pyramid stage just before lunch. They rocked. Yesterday, Paul Weller. We're going to see Rolf later.
We?
Oh, my mate Steve. He seems he's disappeared somewhere. He'll be back. I'll just wait here, if that's okay. He's just over there by the beer tent, chatting up that blonde. He'll be back for me soon enough, you'll see.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
I had performed in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in Plymouth in 1979, but I have to admit I really wasn't a very good singer at the time. I got away with it, just, but always sang a wee bit flat. No one ever told me to sit on a note. Filming for months and earning pots of money, nearly all the pirates and policemen bought houses on that film, for just miming, dancing and faux-fighting on a mock-up pirate ship in Shepperton Studios, was about the best job a tall, energetic, not very good at singing, youngish actor could possibly ask for. Kevin Kline played the Pirate King. The inevitable and endless repetition of the scenes during filming meant that I at least knew the lines to the songs when it came to my turn to play the part on stage. The film's director was a man called Wilford Leach, and he wanted to do take after take from every conceivable angle, so the words were seared into my brain.
So how important is that, let's say, being a friend, a counsellor, you know, an arm around a shoulder for fellow actors? How important is that for you? Because I'm presuming that, in large part, acting is quite a solitary profession. If you are constantly battling, constantly worrying that the phone won't ring, that maybe you need a new agent, a better agent, maybe you need a new take your career into a new direction. But then all of a sudden you're thrust into this one thing which has been the constant, a professional constant for the last 40-odd years. So how important is, you know, is the solidarity of the actors on that docudrama, on that soap? And then how does that kind of play out into other bits of your acting career, maybe?
Well, I think, actors are always accused of being kind of very, you know, surface and self-obsessed. And there are certain, you know, there's a certain truth to that. But you know who your friends are. And when, you know, when things go wrong, you do know who your real friends are, and that's nothing to do with acting. That's to do with friendship. So it's the same. It would be the same whatever job you were doing. You know, you find out who your friends are. It's the ones who actually get in touch when things are really bad. But also, there's the other thing is that, you know, depression is infectious, and I understand it if you're being desperate and clingy, and people back off a bit because they go, oh God, he's in a real state. You know, I don't know what to say to him. You know, I get that as well. I mean, you know, I understand that as well. I don't think it's really any different from anybody else, really, just being human. It's about being a friend. And when friends are down, you go and help them, don't you? That's what you do.
But is there a certain type of person that becomes an actor? Somebody who their emotional antenna is maybe dialed up more than the average person, or maybe even turned down, you know, because on the one hand, it seems to me that you need to be thick skinned because you're a freelancer. But on the other hand, you need to be able to recognize the emotional frailty is the wrong word. The emotional high points, low points, middle points, back, forwards, backwards of humanity, to be able to translate that into your act. So you're kind of, you know, it's a volatile business, thinking about it in those terms anyway.
It is. But I don't think there is a type, you know, that becomes an actor. I think there's all sorts of different types of people. And there are the people who are self-obsessed, the people who are sort of self-important, and there are the people who are terribly, terribly sensitive. There are the people who are very, very thick-skinned. I've never really identified my fellow actors as being a particular type, I don't think. You have to have certain things going for you. You know, you have to be able to do the job. You've got to be, to survive. You've got to be good. You've got to be good at it. And you've got to be, you've got to be able to do different things. You can't just do one trick pony. You can't do that. Yes, you've got to be thick skinned. You're absolutely right. But you've also got to be, to be sensitive enough to be able to realize how to do a sensitive performance. I can't really lump us into one box, really, no.
Mm. So if this acting malarkey had never taken off, what would you be doing? Would you have been a children's book author, an accomplished one, or, a jobbing musician, or even a travel writer? What would you have done? Just imagine, that after you studying in Bristol, this acting had come to naught.
Well, if I'd finished it, I was at UEA at East Anglia doing history of art first, and then I got the bug there when I was doing. I joined the Drama Society, and then I went to Bristol Old Vic Theatre School after that. I could have done what my father did, he was a producer, a film producer, worked for J. Walter Thompson. He made TV commercials, and that was great. And it was a really great job. It was really good fun. So I could have been the other side of the camera quite easily. And then I would have had this thing called security. I would have a thing called a job and a pension. Having said that, I am now a pensioner. I actually get a state pension. So that's taken a little bit of the sting out of things. That's quite nice. I don't know. Somebody recently in the army said, what?
Do you feel like a pensioner?
No. I can't believe a pensioner. I'm about 29, is what I feel. And I'm still fit, still fit and active. And I don't feel any different at all from when I was 29, apart from my knees are a bit gone. Knees are a bit weak. And that's from doing Pirates of Penzance, landing on my knees every night for 6 months, 9 months. Mm-hmm. No, that's a ridiculous thing in the world. A pensioner, that's old people. I'm not one of those.
But don't people with a certain kind of perspective and maturity on life after a certain age kind of write books? Isn't it kind of about their life? Isn't that kind of part of the greying of life?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I love writing. I really do. I mean, I've halfway through a novel, which I kind of got stuck on, but I love doing that. But on the other hand, I love editing, on film editing. I love doing that as well. I love music. I love sitting in the evening and just noodling away on the guitar. Some actors, there are thespians, and I'm not one of those thespians. The thespian who says, oh, I can't do anything else. It's the only thing I can do. And I'm absolutely not one of those. This is just one of the things. This is one of the things I happened to do, and I was, I'm all right at it, and I enjoy it. And I've managed to make a living at it. But that's the only reason. And if it all stopped tomorrow, I'd go and do something else.
If I had been there, it would have been unlucky.
What?
Oh, yes. You must have an odd number of people around the table on Christmas Eve.
I don't suppose it's turkey.
No meat at all at that meal, which suits Nevenia, as suddenly she is vegetarian.
Yeah. What does your mother make of that? Well,
fortunately, she is a very tolerant woman. This is what you don't realize. When you are waiting for your baby, you think you can, like a clay pot.
Mold them.
Exactly. But when they come, instantly they are themselves, an individual.
You'd have liked to have been there, though, Lexi, bad luck or not.
Oh, yes, but that was the arrangement when I took the job. I Skyped, of course, but they had a great time, and that's the important thing.
Well, I'm sure they understand.
You can have your own Christmas when you get home. The people are more important than the date, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Top up?
Oh, thank you.
Oh, we've made quite a dent in it.
You're right. It's very good.
Ian?
No, I shouldn't. But, yeah, go on.
Well, we're not just waiting for our baby. We're waiting for the whole thing to start.
Yeah, there's just so much uncertainty. It's really wearing.
I'm sure it will happen for you soon. Kuzmet.
What does that mean?
Good luck.
Thanks.
Who knows? In another life, maybe I could have had your baby. Oh, at last, the food. I'm starving. I must give you some money.
No, you're our guest. I'll go. Ian, could you sort some plates out?
Yeah, sure.
Chopsticks or forks, Lexi?
You have this storyline, which I'm going to hold my hand up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't believe a word of it.
No.
Right. No, that's not quite true. I believe, as I said in this week's show, that a couple of guys who are in love wanted to cement their relationship by having a child, and they just happen to be gay. Mm. Don't have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. Don't have a problem with surrogacy. What I'm struggling with is somebody embarking on a relationship, somebody being Roy, embarking on a relationship with somebody, and within a matter of months, let's say 6 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it is, we're not talking about years, that person who's embarked on a relationship with saying, I want to be a surrogate. And that person, i.e. Roy, then going with them.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been with the Archers?
You know what? Too long, 1984. I'm an old fart.
By this sort of sudden turn in storyline, I never saw it going that way. I don't think any of us did. In fact, you know, because I knew that obviously when we were recording, before this came up for Lexi, I think Pip had just found out she was pregnant. Sort of just before, I think. So I was like, oh, I bet they're going to do something with Pip and the baby, and that's going to go for Ian and, you know, maybe she'll give up the baby for Ian and Adam. That was where my head was going. And then I got my scripts and I went, oh, what? So it's come as much as a shock to myself and Ian, who plays Roy, and I think Ian and Adam, as much as it has the listeners. As a woman, I've really only just now started to look at why and how, and is this feasible? And something I'm sort of reading a lot on is that surrogates, women that choose to be surrogates, tend to be people that have huge empathy in, and I think you had a caller in actually on Dum to Dum about maybe last week or this week, who said, you know, what an amazing gift to give to someone. I'm not sure as a woman myself, Anya, I could ever get my head round using my body to provide a child for somebody else. That's just not in my sort of stratosphere of thinking. But now I'm having to look at that, which is the beauty of being an actor. And it's all happened very quickly. I will agree with you on that. I am going to see how it plays out. I still don't know. I'm as much in the dark as you. I'm still in the, and what you're hearing, will she, won't she, are they not, is it going to work? There's so many factors, as a lot of the fans have said, to think about legally, emotionally, physically. Poor Roy. I mean, really? You know, yes, poor Roy, but obviously maybe this is a side of Lexi. Who knows what her motives are yet as well. She's got two girls. You don't know what she's thinking in terms of, could this mean that her girls can come over, that this would be a chance to maybe establish something here, or that she'd then be able to go back. That I'm not really quite sure yet myself. I was as shocked as you are. And I'm quite fascinated to see where the guys are going to take this one. And if it does go ahead, I just hope and pray that we can make it believable, because I know it's made quite a big impact to a lot of the fans. I've, you know, I do follow you all, and I have been sort of reading and I understand the concerns, but also actually this happens. So, you know, it does, it happens. I don't know anyone that's done it. I do know a gay couple actually that have
have done it, and I'm absolutely desperate to speak to them to see how this all worked for them and the woman that was their surrogate. But yeah, you know, look, I'm a sort of intrigued and scared as well, because I want to keep Lexi who she is at the same time, and this takes her on quite a different path, actually. So we'll see.
Absolutely. It, yeah. It does feel like a completely different path from the Lexi who was,
yeah,
in effect, corralling and leading the pickers who then kind of fell for Roy. This feels like a completely different character. But as the script writers and as you've portrayed, she does have this maternal side. She does talk about her girls back in Bulgaria. And also underlying that has got to be the fact that, you know, she was only in England to earn money. So there's something about sending money back home, which is what a lot of, whether it's Eastern Europeans or African immigrants or Western immigrants, you know, something which people do. So
I know I used to work.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
Whether this goes or not, but I worked for a lady part time when I was out of work for a bit, who she had a housekeeper from the Philippines that has been here. I mean, she's still here. I mean, it must be going on 20 years now. And she has 5 kids back in the Philippines. And the Philippines is a long way. And she works her bollocks off, if I'm allowed to say that. And she just sends all the money back home. And the kids, you know, she has sacrificed that relationship, I guess. I know there's a lot of women on Twitter that are, you know, wow, you've forgotten about the kids and blah, blah, blah. But she, I mean, I think this woman I know gets to see her kids maybe once every 3 years and has done for the last 20 years. So I know it happens. You know, I've been privy to it. And who knows what may come if Lexi does end up being surrogate. I don't know what it means. And, you know, I'm sort of dying to know myself.
Also, I just got to say that Jean Rose, Auntie Jean, that was basically her question as well. So she's a spirit questioner for that answer that you just gave as well. So thank you for that, Auntie Jean. Easy Archers says, ideally, how would you personally like to see Lexi develop? Give us a fantasy storyline.
Wow. Ooh. Oh, wow. Oh, I'd love to end up like, I don't know. I'd love her to end up with her girls in Ambridge. I know a lot of people might not like that.
Well, she best get in before March 2019, because yes, Brexit's going to...
We better get there quick. You know, it may not be possible. Well, someone better pull out the ring then. Whether it be Roy or Rhett, who knows? And I don't know. I mean, because I'm still so fresh and I'm meeting all these characters and the actors that play them, I mean, I know who my favorites are, but I guess I'd love to see her sort of setting up shop in Ambridge somehow and becoming a firm character, maybe.
Well, you know what you need to do? You need to get yourself a part-time job in the village shop.
That, well,
you want to be, if you're next to Susan Carter, you're not going anywhere.
Hilarious.
You know, you know that'd be great double
act. I've got this sort of vision of Lexi, Susan, maybe. I love Linda Snell as well. Oh my gosh, I love her as a character. I love the actress that plays her. I don't know, having a goat farm. And like, you know, having goats and dogs and children and being Lexi, being the sort of maternal one of the group, sort of keeping everyone in check and making things run brilliantly. But of course, then we wouldn't have a soap. It would, you know, it would just be sort of easygoing and everyone would be happy wearing hippie flowers around their head. So I'm not quite sure a fantasy sort of outcome is the best one. I definitely like to see her stay, though. You know, I'm just having it's such a joy. I can't tell you. It's such a joy being part of. Everyone is so fantastic. That no matter where, I just, as long as she never loses a sense of who we've established her to be, I think I'll be quite happy. Whether fans love her or hate her, because there are the haters. I've seen the haters. Don't worry, I'm on it.
Bugger the haters, and bugger them.
Thank you for wanting to come and talk. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go on, grab a seat. Or would you rather sit here?
Oh, no, here's fine.
Okay, great. So, you said you've been thinking about our proposition?
I've been doing some research, looking at the facts.
Well, that's good.
It's also big and complicated. There are things I need to know. I'd like to ask you some questions.
Sure.
First of all, if we were to go ahead, it might be hard for me to work full-time through the whole pregnancy. My work can be quite physical, on my feet all day.
Yeah, of course.
We understand that.
So, if that were the case, would you make that possible for me? To make up my wages?
Yes.
Definitely. Obviously, we'll cover your expenses.
Well, that would be a part of the deal, of course.
Oh, okay.
And would see to any extra costs, any other unforeseen expenses?
We're prepared to be very flexible about all that kind of stuff.
But you must understand, for me, some other things are more important.
Okay.
So, what kind of...
Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to give up one of my own eggs. I'd find that difficult. So it would have to be donated.
Sure, that's fine. That's no problem, is it, Adam?
Not at all. We're already on the waiting list for a donor egg.
I'm sorry to be so strict about
this. No, don't worry.
Look, we know it's a huge ask for you.
All right.
So is there anything else?
Yes. There is one more thing. If I were to get pregnant, I would want to spend more time at home with my girls.
That's home as in...
Bulgaria, yes.
I see.
Listen, you have been such a breath of fresh air to the world of the Archers.
Any time.
And also to Dum Dum the podcast. So I'd just like to thank you for coming on and answering my questions and also the questions of the listeners. And sorry, John Kavanagh, Ruth Erian, Ben Johnson, Waking Kraken, Barry Editor One, for not getting to the end of all of your questions. But I gave it a good
stab. Ramble. I don't think you've had much time. We'll need another podcast, Royfield. We'll have to listen, do another one.
Have you back on at any time. Folks, don't forget... You can follow all our goings on dumdydum.com. Go there. It's got a shop. It's got the forum. And it's also got Tractor, where you can simply go on to Tractor and decide, I live here or I work there. I want to hang out with other Archers obsessed people. On social media, of course, you can catch us where specifically on Twitter, we are dumdydum. You can follow me where I'm at Royfield for badly spelt, grammatically poor tweets. Also, there is my co-host at Lucy V. Freeman. And of course, there is Naked Fingers on the Twitters. And of course, on Facebook, go on there, just type in Dumdy Dum. And you can follow our goings on there. Now, Miss Anya, is there anything else you would like to say before we complete and utterly sign off? Anything like burning away, then you thought, damn it, I didn't talk to him about this?
Someone asked, who would you duel at dawn? I liked that.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Me, darling, all the way. Let's go back really? To desserts and everything else. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There's so much we can talk about. It's for another podcast. I'd happily come back anytime.
Just before we go, I know that you've made some great friendships since you've been part of the Archers crew. Who's your best mate? Who's your mucker?
I have to say, Stephen, who plays Ian, and I, we're like kids. We just, if we were, I think one of our directors said to us the other day, my God, if you'd been in the classroom, you'd have been the two that we separated. We have a right giggle. And obviously Ian that plays Roy, I mean, he was the first person. He took me under his wing. And so those two really are my biggest confidants right now. Yeah, definitely.
Well, you know what we'll do next time?
Yeah.
We'll actually get you and Stephen on together. How's that? Because it is actually what you asked.
It is, yes. I just because I adore him and he brings so much to the table every time. And also, look, he's my sort of wingman as well at the minute, you know, as someone that's still relatively new, you know, I don't know all the answers. I'm going along and taking in as much as I can. But he's a right giggle. I think you'd be surprised. He's brilliant.
Because you know what? You know, Ian Craig, actually, the character, he's a bit dour.
Yeah. I think let's be a bit fair. I think, you know, sometimes storylines have you maybe having to be a bit repetitive for a while, and sometimes, you know, things go on, and I think sometimes it's very storyline dependent on whether your character's being liked or not. But Stephen is probably, and I've only known him, you know, I know people say, oh, Lexi's only known Adam and Ian a few months. I've only known Stephen, you know, we've only really had our storylines the last 3 months. Honestly, we do not shut up when we're together. I mean, he's coming around for dinner next week. I can't wait. So.
Right. So I'm going to be in London when end of Feb. So where are we going for this date then? Because you said you wanted a hot black podcaster.
Black podcaster all the way. Depends how, you know, depends how much cash you got in your pocket, mate. Well, where we go, we have to see.
I thought you're a modern woman. I thought you believed in the equal division of responsibilities.
Do you know, again, this came up yesterday. I went on this blind date and I paid half. And I am a modern woman. So I found myself after the date going, should I feel weird that I sort of wanted him to pay for the first date? I mean, it wasn't very expensive. Did he not like me, or does this still stand? Or as a modern feminist, am I supposed to, you know, put my hand in my pocket? But I'm also quite, you know, an old romantic. I like someone to look after me a little. It's honestly, I'm a bit flummoxed by it. So
I couldn't agree with you more on this. Right. Yeah. When I was doing the whole swipe left, swipe right thing, what I kind of realized, talking to my brother about this, and my brother is what, 34?
Right.
He was like, no, you all just go halves. And I'm like, but do you really?
Mm.
No, you know, you are the man. And I think it's kind of generational.
Yeah.
That if you're in your 20s, first date, it's completely and utterly down, you know, down the middle.
Absolutely.
And the older you get, the more that kind of, that old fashioned kind of, and I'm completely and utterly like, I'm a man and whatever, but I'm no sexist, caveman.
No.
But you just think, it's just what you do. You just pay on that first date. But, you know, and my brother was like, absolutely. He says, no.
Wow.
He says, you don't know where this is going, whatever. They're as broke as me. You know, I'm as broke as them. Sorry, no, that you don't even think about it. And I just said, no, that's wrong. I don't know.
I sort of agree with you, and I am. You know, I'm very much for equality. You know, I'm with the movement, but there are certain sort of things that I, as a woman, I guess I don't know that I don't expect it, but it just feels nice, and it feels sort of chivalrous, and, you know, and all those things. And I was pretty flummoxed, but I have to say, I was a bit disappointed that he hadn't paid. I was a little bit like, oh, okay. All right. Okay. Is this modern living now? Oh, wow.
Up until that moment, had the date been going well?
It had. He was very, very sweet. I'm not quite sure we were right for each other. But he's a very, very lovely guy.
So it was a mutual friend that set you both up.
Plus, it was actually Kelly Bright. Kelly Bright and her two very.
So, you know, he should be complaining to, then it's her.
No, well, I called her, but she was at the NTAs last night. So, we haven't had the conversation yet. I can't believe I'm telling you this.
You're not just telling me this, you're telling about 30,000 others. This is fantastic. No. This is podcasting gold.
This is real life. This is real life.
So if you are actively dating, yeah. Right, are you actually, are you on an app? Are
no,
you...
don't do the apps. I am so not an internet dater. It's not my thing. I've had friends in the past go, oh, just try it. I've been on it. And I end up, for some reason, Royfield, this might make you laugh. It should make you laugh. I'm not sure whether to laugh or cry. I can remember going on one and thinking, you know, look, I'm not a recognizable face. I'm the sort of the actress that people go, oh, we've met before. And I'm like, no. And then I say I was in Luther or something like that. And they go, oh my God. Oh my God. You know? So I have tried, but I ended up going on one. Literally every guy that got in touch with me was, I put my age range in as I think 30 to 50 or something. Every guy that got in touch with me was over 60. I kid you not. I mean, I think I took photos just as evidence of this. And then you could see who'd been looking at you. And I got slightly freaked out because an old acting teacher of mine was on there. And I, literally when I saw that, I was like, no, this is just not for me. This is not how I roll. I am very much someone that every partner I've met has been quite synchronistic, or somebody that I've known for a while that we've then got together. And again, there is my old fashioned romance. You know, I'm quite old fashioned. I'm a modern woman, but I love a bit of sort of, you know, the idea of synchronicity and things coming together when they're supposed to. The idea of swiping left and right. I mean, some of the stuff I've seen on those sites is just horrifying.
But how? How? Let's take out friends setting up blind dates, because I think even that's incredibly rare now.
Yes.
Or at least it's a, you know, it's an art form which is dying out, you know. How do you actually truly meet people? I don't mean you. I mean, you know, adults now. Because even though where the social and where the professional is incredibly blurred now, we don't, you know, going to a bar and chatting the person up next to you, or at least having a conversation which then falls into chatting up, that art seems to have died a death, really, because of the rise of the internet. So now I put it to you again, madam, how the hell do you really meet people? Not you, but, you know.
I ask myself that question. So do a lot of my single friends. I think I truly, truly, all I can say to you is I am still a believer that it will be by literally somebody picking up the note you just dropped in a shop. And I'd love to think that it's, you know, something like that. I think, you know, look, I don't know, Royfield, what else you do if it's just podcasts. I don't know your background, but...
Well, that's the reason why I don't meet anyone, because all I do is, you know, I travel the world, but I'm always by myself.
Yeah. And that's when it becomes hard. Well, maybe, you know, what did you say again? San Francisco planes. I know a lot of people that have met each other on planes. That always seems to be a good place. The Mile High Club. I honestly can't answer. I can't give you an answer to that, because I think there's a lot of us in the same boat. And that's whether you're, you know, acting and on a set, or stuck doing your podcasts, or, you know, I'm the same. I do a lot of voiceover, and that's very you on your own with an engineer in the other room, and that's about it. And they're banging on about their girlfriend, and you're like, oh, right, well, you're taken. Okay, back home to my dog then.